Wow. I had an absolutely amazing weekend in Gimli. Hey there. I'm Ryan Funk here with you for another episode of U-Talk. Thanks for tuning in to 101.5 FM. So I was on Gimli this past weekend for the Gimli International Film Festival, and it was just an absolutely amazing time. So let's take a quick look back at some of the interviews I was able to do before the festival. We've got filmmakers are taking part in the 48-hour film festival, documentary films, feature films, a whole amazing list. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Hi there, I'm Cecilia Araneda, and I am the director of the short film On Archive. On Archive isn't actually screening as part of the Gimli Festival, but it is the award recipient of the Barry Lenk Documentary Prize, from Doc Manitoba. So it will have like a special sneak preview or screening or whatever you want to call it at the awards ceremony.
Ooh, that sounds a lot of fun. Awesome. So Ian, tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Ian Singh Bawa. I'm a South Asian filmmaker from Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm one of the two directors of Seeking Fire, which is playing the Gimli Theater on the 28th and 29th of July. And I'll let Kwan introduce himself and maybe talk what the actual film's about.
Awesome. All right, Kwan, tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm Kwan Leung, the other director of Seeking Fire, and also co-director of photography on the film as well. It's a feature documentary about people's relationship with money, especially in the fire community or lifestyle, which is short for financial independence, retire early. It's a group of people who try to save and invest and live their life somehow to retire earlier than usual. But through it, we kind of put ourselves in the film and found that it's much more about what you want to do and your life rather than all about the numbers and money.
So this is a very exciting opportunity, seeing these films and like acknowledging films at the Gimli International Film Festival. But let's get into the nitty gritty of, you know, what it takes to make a documentary. I've already had the opportunity to connect with Catherine Delude. She has a documentary short that'll be showcased there, and she's it's called I Would Like to Thank My Body. And she mentioned that as she was, you know, going through this, she got very close to the subjects, and because of that, they were able to work together and collaborate. So she didn't really have a lot of extra footage by the end of it. They were able to just get exactly what they needed every time. For all of you, when you're filming a feature-length documentary, what is sort of your approach, and do you end up with just a ton of footage on the cutting room floor?
It was kind of both our first time working on something of this scope and scale and certainly length, for myself at least. So it was very daunting and very overwhelming to see where we go, what should we film, who do we meet, things like that. But we had a good team with us from Farpoint Films. Our producer, Chris Charney, really helped us navigate the way. And he's also really, really interested in the topic as well. And also our friend Marcus Henko, who shot the film with us, and that really helped drive us through. And at first we thought it was more about, you know, the people and explaining this thing and seeing how their lives are, kind of traditional documentary, but Chris really pushed Ian and I to be in the film more and be the driving force of the story. And so it ended up being a lot about ourselves and our story, and that comes in certain challenge and positive, because then we can shoot whenever we want and work around our schedule, but then also we're always on camera almost. Yeah. And I would direct Ian's scenes and Ian would direct scenes of mine, and we ended up shooting I think 30 days, right Ian? Something like that,
yeah.
Which is apparently spot on the producer's guesstimate, and a lot was on the cutting floor for sure. We ended up making it.
What about you, Cecilia? What was the experience like creating your documentary?
Yeah, so my film is short, so it's not a feature film.
Oh, okay.
And so I do make a number, like my principal body of work is documentaries, experimental documentaries specifically. And I take the approach of that everything is a personal journey. So kind of like how your producer was telling you guys to make that. I think it's a very common approach. So how it relates to every film every particular film is going to be different, how that is personalized. Obviously an experimental documentary is not going to be the same as kind of a more traditionally framed documentary, but the approaches could probably still be very applicable and similar. And for me, an archive is considering my own cultural history and background and the start of my dad's Alzheimer's journey. So the two things kind of related in my mind to me. In October 2020, something major happened in my home country, which is Chile, where there were a lot of unprecedented demonstrations that really, it was October 2019. There was unprecedented demonstrations over the increase of the subway fare. And at the same time, globally, there was a lot of unrest. It was just before COVID came. There was unrest in Hong Kong. There was a whole bunch of things happening, which were almost very parallel. And in Chile, it was really unprecedented. And historically, what would happen in South America prior to this was that they would send the military out and kill a bunch of people. But they couldn't. And they also couldn't control this movement because it was a leaderless movement, which when you have nobody to negotiate with, it becomes really difficult. Like, I mean, we saw a snippet of that maybe in Ottawa with a convoy but even then there were leaders there that they could pick out. And so that became a little more feasible to manage somehow. But in Chile, it was completely leaderless. So there was nobody to negotiate with, et cetera. And so the government did send out the military once. And then the military at that point just said, like, we're not civil action. You guys have to get your police together. If you can't figure this out, it's not for us. And quite frankly, the military at that time, I mean, modern military doesn't want to spend their time in jail, so or in prison, international prison. So I'm sure nowadays, countries would consider it differently. But in the past, that would have been what Chile would have done. And so as it was going through that, I really thought about how the only reason things have changed really, aside from social movements. In that particular case of that, it was just, there was 100,000 cameras everywhere, right? Like, so that the police could not, and the same thing kind of in Hong Kong, perhaps, although that's a whole other political system, but there was like 100,000 cameras on everything. And I was reflecting on the idea of how the social justice movement has really been enabled by the camera over the years, because it's, the act of self-surveillance in a way.
With the George Floyd situation, right? How many times has a black man been killed that was never on camera?
Yeah. And so that it was a very similar thing that was happening in Chile. And I don't it didn't have a clean ending, and the aftermath is very complex, and I'm not going to say that it was like black or white, one side or the other is right. Although one side was more right, I would say, and so at that moment I dawned on me that my father was the family photographer, and he had forgotten that he had ever taken any photographs, and yet all of our family archives were of his taking. And so I made this film that connected these two things, occurrences. And Chile is a place of, it's not only my birthplace, obviously, it's my dad's birthplace as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was really important for me to contextualize the coming to Canada and the process of understanding how, these things, histories will repeat themselves over and over again, but for the act of witness that the camera does. And so I kind of wanted to pull that all together. It's a process-based film. It wasn't really a cleanly, you know, a linear film. It has like a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I won't say that it doesn't, but it's not an expected film anyways. And certainly I will
say, there's like, the experimental part to it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of found footage. I talk a bit about the history of Chile, and I also, you know, it's challenging for, I guess, a Canadian audience. It's an immigrant experience film in a way, but it also talks about a lot about Chile's political history, which may or may not mirror other political histories for immigrant experiences as well. So in a way, but in a way, it's the story of me coming to terms with my father's Alzheimer's as well. And I think a lot of people actually can relate to that. If it's not Alzheimer's, it's something else as well.
As Cecilia was mentioning, you know, sometimes it's a little messy when you're putting a story together, and especially for Life, it isn't a cohesive narrative necessarily. So how did you and Quan tackle your story? How did you find that? You were talking a little bit about how your producer told you to put the camera on yourself and the story of yourself, but how do you develop that story and concept into that final product?
Well, we I think naturally just had a bunch of stuff going on in our lives. Quan and I are about just like 12 years apart, but we're good friends. And we're, you know, Quan immigrated here when he was younger. I had parents who were immigrants. So we have like similarities, but differences. And because of like the different, like I've gone through some of the stuff Quan has, and Quan's trying to like just starting to do certain things. So we had things happening as we were starting to shoot. For Quan, he was buying his first piece of property, which is like a big investment at the time. And we showed the stresses of being like a young person just trying to figure your life out. Be like, do I want to spend all this money to have a place where I put my stuff? Or do I want to explore the world? Or do I want to like figure that out? And then on my end of things, my father passed away back in 2020. And I was just about to sell the family home, which was really effing hard. and it was just one of those things where I didn't know. I was like, what am I doing? Like, I'm selling this and I'm gonna have a stack of money, and then I'm going to what, travel? I don't know, like, this is blood money. And we were both going through our own personal stresses, and you know, again, it was all, I sometimes think shooting documentaries is almost like accidents happening, and then you kind of find the accidents and you go, there's a story here, I think. And that's what kind of happened. We just had our own stuff going on, and Quan would be like, we should shoot that, or maybe we should shoot this. And, you know, same thing would happen on his side. And we kind of just would piece it together as it goes. It is funny though. I think it's like, in the end, the film is very close to what we had, like, is pretty much what we initially pitched, though we had no idea it was going to be as well as it is, or as like, you know, cohesive as it is based on our own personal stories.
Oh, and another thing I want to say, Cecilia, I don't know if you kind of have had a through line as your story through line as you were making it, and then getting stuff for it, you know, like, oh, I got to say something about this part of history. And then I go up, like, for us, we didn't really know what the story was about. And I think that was a big learning experience to either work with writers or figure it out better, because we really waited till we wrapped shooting and then hope for the best. Or I think right before our last shooting block, I was editing like a rough cut together, and I even did it on a plane to Vietnam when we shot a little bit. And then that story outline, it ended up changing so much, so we didn't really know what we were doing. But I don't know if that was the same for you, Cecilia.
Yeah, like, I mean, it just depends. What you have an issue with is, I think every filmmaker wants to work that way if they have the money and not an infinite amount of money and time, because it's like an interesting way. Because when you're working on a film project, I think there's like all of these like tangent film projects that spoke out of them, and I think everybody would want to pursue them. But I talk a lot about the process. My experimental filmmaking practice is something that spoke out of this experimental filmmaker in Toronto. His name is Phil Hoffman, and he has a big you know, a family tree underneath him of or above him. I don't know how that works. Filmmakers in Canada who are part of his like filmmaking family tree, and I am one of them. And the process is basically to allow yourself to step into it without a preconceived notion of what you're going to make. And so I actually write the narration in all of my films at the very end after I've edited, picture edit. So with the exception, I did actually make a feature film recently. So obviously that you can't, I guess you could, but it's an infinite amount of money at that point, right? When you bring in actors mm-hmm. and stuff and from other cities, et cetera. So it's not to say that every single one of my films is done that way, but I try to when I can. The whole mechanism of the process is to trust that you're going to find the film. If you're honest in the process and if you're honest with what you're doing and you're true to yourself, the film will reveal itself. So Unarchive was actually made completely like that. I wanted to make a film about my father somehow. And while I was in the process of starting it, I had already filmed some of it. And then I realized I could not film him anymore. There was a certain point where ethically, I just realized it was not possible to film anymore. And then I had like left the whole summer. And then in the winter, I had been in another country. I was in Austria doing an artist residency there and basically spent my time editing this film. And while that happened, while I was editing, that's when the social movement in Chile happened. So it was like this event infused itself into my film when it was never really about that. And in the moment that it was happening, I knew that I had to respond to that. And I knew that my dad would want me to respond to that as well. So I guess it's a roundabout way to say that you guys are working in the process. So good on you.
And I think that answers my question about what is the power of documentary. Well, it's raw and it's fluid, and you find this story within the lives of people.
Yeah, like, awesome. I mean, it's for me personally, I have yet to, I don't, well, you know what, I did make a documentary once on Antro, who's like the Winnipeg poster guy. I'm not sure. I did make that one, with the exception, which is the first time I entered into a process where I had no idea, like I didn't really know the subject at all prior to filming. I just like, this is an interesting thing.
Just thrown right into the deep end.
And I was like, I've seen this guy around for a while. But with the exception of that documentary, for the most part, I don't really make any films that I don't really don't have anything to do with me personally. Like the content wise is all something that speaks to me, and they all of my films build upon each other. I don't make these one-off films. I'm not the best business person when it comes to filmmaking, like unlike the guys at Farpoint Films. Like maybe I need to get them to like produce my next feature film. Maybe they would like get me more efficient or something like that. But but I do manage to make a living off of filmmaking in spite of this. So I do think that there's something really powerful about honesty and making sure that for whatever reason you're making the film, whatever the subject is, that it is honest and you're doing it because you really need to be making that film and not because you think it's a good idea that could sell to television. And maybe the guys at Farpoint have a different way, you know, way of saying that, but I think they'll agree with me too.
Yeah, I also like that. I feel like with docs or the ones that I'm interested in making myself, it's kind of stories that it's like I don't make stuff about big stories that everyone knows already, or you know, like it's kind of always like a niche, or like I made a short doc recently about a girl who was getting over her addiction to self-harm, and I'm like, no one, like even I wouldn't have known about her if it wasn't for like documentary filmmaking or opportunities like this. So that's what I like especially short documentaries, which I'm very fascinated with. It's like a piece of life that you're getting, and it's not something you already know. It's just, hey, here's a cool story, and you should really know about this.
This is kind of a two-part question. I'm not sure what other sorts of projects you've worked on in the past, but if you have worked with real actors and also documentaries, you know, what are the pros and cons with, you know, working with an actor for telling a story? Because I know docudramas are pretty popular right now with, like, the Elvis Presley movie, Rocket Man, Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, the pros and cons of potentially working with actors versus working with real people.
I know personally, I like documentaries, not the thing I do regularly. So this is, this is a, kind of a first, my first documentary feature. I've done a couple of shorts with Kwan, and I've done a couple of shorts here and there, but like, in general, I personally am a narrative filmmaker. I like control. I'm too much of a control freak, which is like, you know, and that being said, I just love watching documentaries. I enjoy making documentaries, but it's a different world. It's a different stress level. I like being able to use my words to kind of, you know, create the scene. But that being said, you still use your words. It's just, how to communicate and engage with someone to get them to, you know, give you the information that you sometimes need, or, you know, to activate the situation, or understand the situation, or understand what they've gone through, or things like that. So it's a different, it's layers of different communication, is how I see the difference. But truly, I think I'm more of a narrative person overall.
And I guess just between those two versions, you know, how is it working with an actor versus working with real people in that situation? Is it harder or easier? You know, what's that like?
I think they're both different things. I think they're both equally can be hard or difficult based on days. I've been in interviews where I'm like, this guy's giving me nothing. You know, why'd you say you wanted to be part of this, dude? You know, and then I've had like times where you sit down and they just want someone to hear their story, and you're just like, Jesus. And like, you're like, you know, and same with the other things with like actors. You have days where you're like, this guy's a trained actor and they're not giving me much, and you're trying to figure it out. You know, it's puzzle piecing. You know, being a filmmaker is problem solving. It's just, and that's part of it. It's just different forms of it.
I'm a cinematographer by trade, and that's what I aim to do. But whenever I make my own films, I like to make documentaries as a director. And I just feel like, first of all, as a cinematographer, I work on both scripted and unscripted projects, documentary and narrative projects, I mean. And it's very intertwined, I guess. Like, I love, my favorite films are things that look really natural and almost documentary, like Nomadland or Chloe Zhao's other movie, The Rider, which, you know, they're taking the documentary instincts and crafting it into scripted work. And like you said, a lot of docudramas are very popular right now. And the only short film that I've ever directed is called Container. And it's based on a true story as well. And I shot it like a documentary. I locked up all the actors in a U-Haul, made it a container, and put that operator and the sound person in there and locked them all up and make them shoot the movie. And it's almost like if I were to make narrative films, I would do it like that, you know, like I would create a scene and shoot it like a doc. Like, we didn't have lights or stands or C-stands everywhere. I built the lights into the set as a DP. I like that. Like, it's almost like making a documentary scene out of it. But on the other hand, in a documentary, you're still approaching the story almost, I don't know, like I approach it almost like a narrative film where you have, as a cinematographer, I shoot it like, yeah, whatever, wide, medium, close up. But there's a shot in Seeking Fire, which is my favorite shot, is when we've just done a scene on Ian at his dad's place. And then our other camera guy, Marcus, was going out and shooting house B-roll. And I was in the backyard filming, and then Ian sat down on the steps of the backyard and started crying. And I put the camera down and I hit cut, and then I went over and hugged him. And I still think about it sometimes, like, should I have kept the camera rolling and go in and hug him? Or did I make the right choice? You know, like I always wonder that, and that's the blurred line between documentary and drama, I think. Like, in a drama, probably I would have gone in and, like, shoot close-ups or something. I don't know. But as a documentary filmmaker, you also have that sense of sensibility and where, how far you're willing to go. Anyways, long rants, but I work on both, and I really enjoy when it the two mixes, like, together. Like, tomorrow I go and film, which would be part of a first feature for me as a cinematographer, and it's, again, docudrama, and it's a true story that repeats again, and I'm really going to film it like a documentary with not much lighting, not much crew, and that's why I really enjoy making.
Interest, I'm no longer what you're into. It's in the dull of your eyes, in the fade of your smile. I just don't know what to do. I wish I knew what you were thinking. Wish I knew how I could fix it for you. Wish I knew what you were thinking. What it comes to, heartache in the end. Walking in the cold, buried in the snow. It's not that I can't help you, but I never know how to. I wish I knew what you were thinking. Wish I knew how I could fix it for you. Wish I knew what you were thinking. I tried so hard, tried so hard. Wish you knew what I was thinking. I wish you knew that I could fix it for you. Wish you knew what I was thinking. I tried so hard, tried so hard. I know that I can change, change, change. I'll never lay the blame, blame, blame. Everyone else sleeping, and you cannot close your eyes.
Do you wish you could make everything right? Turn back the clock and take away the thing that changed your life. It's
at the light end. Let the light end.
Greetings, everybody. So I'm Ben, or Ben Drix, that's what I go as. And basically, I've been doing the 48 since 2014. Started doing the 48 in Gimli in 2013 and have been doing it ever since. And I'm always excited about this event and wanting to be a part of the whole festival because it's one of my favorite times of the year.
Awesome. My name is Aaron. I have my first feature-length film that's going to be playing at the Gimli Film Festival. I'm really excited about the festival to see a bunch of movies and then go swimming in between. And yeah, to have my first feature have its premiere. It's great. And the movie's set in the area. So
awesome. Nice.
Takes place in Lake Winnipeg, so it'll be a really good fit.
Awesome.
I'm Deco Dawson. I, too, have a feature film at the Gimli Film Festival this year, Diaspora. It's a film sort of unlike any other. 25 different languages are spoken on camera.
Wow.
The main protagonist is speaks in Ukrainian the whole time, and it all takes place on Selkirk Avenue in the north end of Winnipeg. So happy to have a sort of hometown screening here.
Yeah, of course.
Gimli not being too far, although the two main streets are very different from one another. I'm just, happy to have a chance for Manitobans to come out, get to see this film.
So we've got feature-length films and then a 48-hour film. So, very different approaches and how you have to do that. So, Ben Drix, why don't you tell me a little bit about, 48-hour film festival. How does one approach trying to get a film done in 48 hours?
Yeah, okay, that's a funny question. So you... On a Friday at 6 p.m., you send an email out, and it has the key, which has all the instructions. You can't begin till you get these instructions. Mm-hmm. And you write, shoot, direct, produce, and score a film all within 48 hours, 2 days. So from Friday to Saturday, they make their films. What we do is we start announcing that we're having it in, I think, February. We do registration in March. We do a meet and greet where the city of Winnipeg, where ACTRA, we work with ACTRA actors, so ACTRA allows us to work with actors for free for this festival, where they cover the costs. What else? We have the Winnipeg Film Group. They offer gear and all this other kind of support. And so basically, we have this meet and greet, and then there's this info session where the city and the film group and all these people tell them, here are your resources, here are the things you can do. And then we have a speed dating for filmmakers, but it's not dating, it's just being on a team. So
yeah.
Anybody who's a musician, anybody who's a...
You're like,
a,
I need you. Yeah. I want you.
Yeah, yes, that's come the here, time come to here. Do it. And then we have the challenge in June normally. And then we do a screening in Gimli, and then we do another one at CCFM. And that's been the pattern for, 9 years, I guess, now. So Yeah, and then what happens after the two screenings, we take the top two from every province and territory, because this is a Canada-wide event.
Yeah.
And then they go to the Toronto. We have a relationship with TIFF, the TIFF Bell Lightbox. We have a screening. We just did one in April. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fantastic. They love us. We love them, and we want to keep doing this. And we, you know, and the big thing, the overarching thing that's important about this is one of the it's an exercise, right?
Of course.
To better the filmmakers. So collaboration is important. Development of their skills and creating content, and so therefore it's fantastic because the films go on and some go to other festivals and do well. Yeah. and you know, helps build people's
and
careers.
You never know what you're going to kind of think of in that kind
nope,
of moment. You're
not.
Like, okay, we got, let's go. Whoa, what's this? Throw some ideas at me.
Yeah. And I mean, in short, you know, it's people, you know, taking us, you know, throwing everything at you know, at it at the same time while they're trying to follow these instructions, and you don't know what's going to come of it, and you know, and it's amazing because sometimes there's some brilliant work, and I think it's one of the best ways to help a filmmaker get into it and kind of like just make stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Aaron Decco, what is the process of making a feature length piece? Like, obviously it doesn't have the same limitations that a 48-hour film has, but there are other challenges that you have to overcome. So Aaron, why don't you just start with telling us a little bit about your process of your film?
I would love to, yeah. And I'm almost thinking like a 48-hour limit might have been nice, because I spent years working on this thing. So I forgot to say before, but my film's called Arutane. And the process was long. I finished university, was thinking, okay, I'm done with film, but then started working on this idea really slowly. And then
it sucks you back in.
After a few years of hammering out the plot, I had a script in 2017 and started trying to get money to make it. Because with a short film, you can kind of get away with like making it for very cheap, like, you know, pooling your own money, or, you know, getting people to,
when you're in your early
20s, you can get people to do it as a favor, but okay, you're making a feature. You want to pay people, you want to do it right. So I spent 2 years trying to get money, finally got the funding in 2019, and then it was blast off. Mm. So it was an intense 30 days of filming, 2 years of editing.
Oh, man.
Because it was an ambitious project and I was doing many roles myself. But yeah, it was, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Of course. Like, you never know what sort of things you're going to learn about yourself and the project as you're going through it.
Yes. And you learn a lot of, like, what not to do next time. Will there be a next time? No. And then you, yes.
Yes.
You finish, and then you're happy with it. And then you think, yes, I want to do this again. I've kind of caught the bug, so I've got a new feature script in the works.
Yeah. Or you pull George Lucas, and you're never happy with it.
Yeah, there can be a bit of that.
Decco, what about your film? What sort of challenges and experiences did you have through your process?
You know, I'd done, you know, an enormous number of short films over the course of my career. Having the opportunity to do a feature, the film is produced by Eagle Vision Productions. So I was lucky. We had a great, you know, sort of funding structure for it, as well as a great team for production. And we were able to do everything that was in the script, you know, kind of thing. I felt very, very, this project had sort of fallen onto me at the right time, you know, when I needed it, when I was ready for it. And everyone who was able to contribute to the film, worked on the film, you know, I wanted to do this sort of hybrid of sort of indie, you know, Winnipeg Film Group inspired kind of collective energy. But I knew that, of course, we would have, you know, timelines and deadlines and, you know, unions and overtime, you know, so you had to be rather rigid in that. And so how can you work with that? Luckily, I had, as I had said, set it all in Winnipeg in one particular area. which we just set up shop. We set up shop on Selkirk Avenue in one of the elementary schools that wasn't being used for the summer. Mm-hmm. And we could essentially walk to so many of the locations and take sort of splinter vehicles along the way. And it really gave a sense of camaraderie with the neighborhood and with everyone working on the film. So I was really, really fortunate to have a lot of flexibility in how to do this. And it was shot in a very unconventional way, yet still within the parameters that you'd be forced into with the way that an industrial shoot does go. Mm-hmm. So really, I have absolutely no complaints. It was such a fulfilling process. Working with all new Canadians was the intent was, you know, to really capture the vibrancy of the neighborhood. And this idea, this experience of if you came to Canada not knowing anyone, what would you find? And you'd end up finding a neighborhood of a lot of people in the same situation who don't speak the same similar language. So there was a lot of fun. The script was all written, but there was room for improvisation, you know, on the day. And then the pandemic hit, so, you know, I too had several years of post-production isolation at home. Which again, like, I was wearing a lot of hats myself, and it took that amount of time to really, you know, massage it into its sort of unconventional form that it is. It was really to capture that spirit of which I'd harnessed in my short films, in working with so many people who, as Aaron said, you know, can kind of like help you up and, you know, give a hand and try in this case to pay people to do the same thing. And I think the film, you know, reflects an authenticity that you can't get mm-hmm. if you were, you know, in a very sort of rigid, you know, had a very rigid approach to it.
And you mentioned it was 25 languages featured in it?
Yeah, there's 25 different international languages spoken in the film. There's just one scene with English in it. But yeah, as I said, Ukrainian is the main. And this was all written and filmed before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So before we had millions of Ukrainian immigrants, you know, scattered.
Yeah, Manitoba has changed so much now.
The film's called Diaspora, which is, you know, the spreading of one from one's homeland. Mm-hmm. And that happened, you know, like right after, you know, this had all been shot and been put together. So it has this poignancy, you know, that wasn't particularly relevant beside it being, you know, a shared experience with so many multicultural groups. In this case, now being Ukrainian is like, you know, is exceptionally relevant and prevalent.
I think it's just a great example, snapshot of what Manitoba is, and it's changed so much. I was raised in Winkler for most of my life. And even now, driving there, visiting family, just how much the community has changed because of immigration and the different people coming in has really given it a new spark of life, just changing it, seeing the different people there. And I think that's an exciting part about film, is that you can capture something from life and put it into a medium. So the three of you, what is your favorite aspect of making a film? For you, what is it that you're like, is that spark of inspiration when creating it?
I guess I'll go.
Hey, guys.
Fight for it. Let's go.
No, we can just keep going down the road.
Yeah, whatever. It works out. Actually, it's funny. I have made some films, a few, but I don't get a chance to often. I consider myself more of an editor. Mm-hmm. I'm touching my chest. however, here's the thing. Like the times that I have, and when I do start editing, one of my favorite components is the sound.
Yeah.
And I teach editing at the University of Winnipeg right now. So it's really interesting because I always find that sound is a really good component. And
it can make or break a film.
Yeah, it does, but you know, and also the tie-in with Deco's saying that like a huge part of it for me is, and this ties in with the 48 and just my overall thinking. Like I, you know, language is a big part of the 48. It's one of the pillars. So we tell people, make a movie in your native tongue
or just use a phrase of French or something. We need you to start using, you know, like looking at, you know, this is a mosaic, as they call it, Canada, right? You know, there's so many different people here. Let's start like showcasing it, because I think a lot of festivals and a lot of films don't really push or encourage it as much. And I think it's important. People shouldn't feel like they have to only speak English. And that's why I loved your film. Because I was like, because I didn't know what it was going in. And I was like, what? This is crazy. Exactly how I think. And, you know, and I've traveled a lot. And I try to learn the languages of the places that I go. Yeah. So, like, I know bits and pieces of, like, four different languages outside of English. So I'm very, very passionate about that. So the sound, language, and... I mean, visual component's important, but being able to tell a story with the sound elements is, you know, is really the like one of the most powerful things for me as a person who's an editor.
Yeah.
You know,
visual, like sound, and editing. You need all pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm you know, because it doesn't get spoken about a lot. I think the sound component is my favorite part. It draws you in or takes you out. And I'll throw another quick thing in there, just really quick, because I was just watching Interstellar the other day. It's a second time. And, you know, it's not like the best film or anything, but there are moments when the sound just goes out and it's like, what? And it just, it's like, man, that's powerful. I totally dig that. And, you know, anyway, that's one of my favorite parts of it, really.
I'll kind of echo what you were saying, because sound is a really big part of my filmmaking practice, mostly in post, like during the filming. It's about, you know, recording the sound there as best you can, but then really having fun in post-production, playing with layers of textures. Mm. So if you see my film, A Routine, you'll get to, there's a lot of scenes where there's just really, really good textures going on, these different layers that you can kind of enjoy there. But another aspect, like during the actual production, that I like best is, so I like having like a pretty good idea in mind, like I have an image in my mind of what this scene is gonna be. Mm-hmm. But I also love like being totally open to everything changing in the moment.
Yep.
Like you have your location and you see this like weird chair in the corner that wasn't part of the script. You're like, okay, you're not gonna be standing anymore. You're gonna be sitting on that weird chair. You're going to be standing beside her, and that's how it's going to go, and it's going to be great. Or maybe an actor. Like, I always love, like, I like working with really small crews, and I like everyone having the ability to, like, have an idea. I'm not always going to go with it, but a lot of the time, like, an actor or the sound person, they'll have this great idea, and I'll be like, yeah, let's try that. So, like, the script, I feel good about my scripts, but they're not sacred, like, can throw something away in the moment. Yeah. If something's not working, don't force it. Unless it's like some complicated plot thing where, okay, no, she has to mention the pendant because 20 scenes from now it's gonna come up again. But otherwise, being open to things changing and incorporating interesting things that are just there when you arrive. That's my favorite part.
Amazing. Deco.
Yeah, I would have to, you know, echo both of those. For me, I've been a visual filmmaker, where sound has been very important, but a lot of, you know, constructed music to support the sound in my previous films. And I decided with Diaspora to have no soundtrack to it, no music scored for the movie, and instead have diegetic sounds. So there's just every shop she walks into, there is sound, you know, sounds coming out of, you know, cars driving by. There's two live bands that are featured in it. That those are all recorded live on the floor on the day of. No canned, lip synced audio in there, and I really took on the exploration of sound for this film as sort of the next frontier I had not explored yet, to the degree that I had, you know, other parts of filmmaking, and in that, you know, recognized what I would do next differently, the ambitions that I had for the sound. I could recognize, start with a conversation with your sound recordist, understanding how, you know, industrial shoots happen, and sound is given such a small priority on set. You know, a DOP, a cinematographer, can say, no, I want to take it again, you know. I think we can grab that a bit better, but the sound person like just does not have that authority to step up and say, yeah, no, like, I think we have more interesting sound happening over here. You know, let's get this at the same time. Sort of relegated into the, you know, the back corners. And then when it was time for post-production on this, we had a sort of sound design happen and the pandemic hit. And so I had the opportunity to dive in for 7 months to then co-design the sound for this film. And I wanted everything to be authentic. So I went down to the back to the neighborhood with mics, recorded just street sounds. The original sound design crew was from Toronto and working out of Toronto. So their idea of what a busy street sounded like was completely different from what a Winnipeg street sounds like. You know, and you like you don't even realize that. You go like, this is what it sounds like. And then, you know, they've got like 100 cars going by, like in the scene, and you know, it's drowning everything out. But if you watch the image, there's like 3 cars going by. And so it was a matter of working towards that authenticity. Mm-hmm. And it ended up that the film's score is now entirely in the sound. And everything you hear, like for example, the sound designer's like, oh my God, you just want no birds in any scenes. And I was like, the birds are too optimistic. They are giving a sense of hope. And it's very, you know, dire and desperate. And no children playing. I don't want to be able to hear children playing outside the window. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we started scrubbing that stuff away or choosing particular sounds that didn't have that, it sounded industrial. And it sounded
changed the tone completely.
Just dirty buses idling outside. And, you know, all of this felt a lot more repressive. And as you're speaking to that, you know, sound had really changed the tone or been able to curate the tone that you want to communicate. And most people aren't watching a movie with their ears, but they're always listening. Mm. And so that was just, you know, to echo, you know, what's being said here, how I think the more time you spend as a filmmaker exploring the different avenues, you find sound to be so powerful and so useful to conveying things that you don't. In future projects, I would not even shoot a scene. I would have the sound do the work off camera. And that would all of a sudden become really interesting as a scriptwriter to say, we don't need to show that, you know? But working in that mindset in that way is something this project has now afforded me moving forward.
Wow. Let me just take some quick notes.
Can I just say something? Yeah, because I saw Deco's film, and I wasn't in the moment like aware of those elements that you mentioned were missing. But now that I think back, I'm like, oh yeah, there wasn't any kids playing, there wasn't any birds, and it kind of like sound works on what you're feeling, and even if you're not like registering, like where are those children? Like it's adding to that feeling, and I had a scene in my film where there was it was this great scene, but there was a weird issue with the camera because we were using this LED flashlight and it created this weird strobe. So the footage was garbage. But we changed it so that, in the editing, I'm like, wait, I'll just like have these atmospheric shots and we're just hearing them talking. And it ended up working great. So good sound saved that scene's butt and it still worked in the end.
Yeah, and to tie in with all these guys are saying, like, you know, I noticed like because I teach, you know, young filmmakers and also these university students, and like, it's always the sound, like the sound effects, like just even a door shutting is a part of the soundscape. It's so important and it makes a huge difference. It's like, hey, if you add this in here, watch what happens. And their mind is blown. They're like, wow, what? And so like, I think it's something, again, we're all visual people. I come from a graphic design background, and you know, I jumped in the film like many years, like close to 30 years ago or something. It's a long time. And so like, really it's like, it blows my mind how it's not in the forefront. And the sound guys on set aren't really, it's always like the cinematographer. Everybody wants to be the cinematographer, the director, but nobody wants to talk about sound. And nobody wants to talk about the edit. Yeah. And
Those are the two areas that are
the unsung heroes.
They're so unsung, it's not even funny.
Hey, thanks for listening. Make sure you tune in at 1 p.m. every Tuesday to catch more stories from your community. I'm Ryan Funk. This was U Talk. And have yourself a good one.